coincident with learning the tools, you also need to learn what does it mean to be authentic. When I look at people's photographs, the first two things I look at are, is the picture authentic? Does it grow directly from the heart and mind of the maker, or is it merely an imitation? We all have in our mind hundreds of thousands of pictures that we see on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. Invariably, we are going to imitate some of those, but we need to find our way through that to discover, who am I really? Once you begin to learn something about what is your own way of seeing, then your own way of seeing becomes more important than the rules that govern a good photograph.
Hey, welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Raymond Hadfield, and today we are chatting with photographer, educator, and author David Ulrich about how to become a more mindful photographer. This episode is brought to you by CloudSpot, the all-in-one solution, way better than Google Drive solution, to deliver and even sell your photos online. You can grab your free forever CloudSpot account with 10 gigabytes of photo storage, all free, over at deliverphotos.com. Today's guest, David, has been shooting for many, 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 many years. And as I mentioned, David is also an author. Now, I picked up his book, The Mindful Photographer, a little bit over a year ago. And I found that it was so full of insight from his decades of experience behind the lens. And it's not so much stories of, you know, being on set or you know, shooting in that moment. It's also not a book on, you know, set your ISO dial here and use a focal length of X and your shot will be great. David's book is full of short essays on what is really important in photography. Things like making creative time, things like seeking resonance in your work, things like avoiding being merely pictorial about your imagery. And I'm the kind of photographer who I thrive on momentum. I mean, just myself in general, but specifically in photography. But inevitably, you know, I also need rest. Everybody needs rest. So in those times where I do need rest, in those times where, you know, I'm busy doing, you know, whatever, house projects, lawn renovation, whatever it is, and I'm not thinking about photography, I can lose that momentum, that creative momentum. And to get back in it is very difficult for me. And I have found that David's book is the perfect tool for me. I can pick it up, flip to any page, read the short, you know, 2-3 page essay about the creative process, and it fills my idea bucket, my creative bucket, and I just find that I'm just thinking about whatever the subject is for the rest of the day, so that when that time comes to pick up the camera again, you know, maybe I haven't had it for a few days, but I've been thinking creatively about imagery for that time, that I can much easier get back in it. You know, maybe you have a 9-to-5 job. Maybe you can only shoot on weekends. You grab a few photos throughout the week, but your main time is the weekend. I really think that David's book here, The Mindful Photographer, allows you to, again, keep that level of creative awareness up high, so that throughout the week, in these times where you can't actually be shooting, you can still be there. You can stay there. And again, it's much easier to get back in when you do pick up the camera with intention. This conversation was an absolute joy for me, and I know that you are going to enjoy it as well. So with that, let's go ahead and get on into today's podcast interview with David Ulrich. David, my first question for you is, when did you know that photography was going to play an important role in your life?
Well, that's a very good question. Although I wasn't aware of this because I was too young, my parents tell me that my favorite toy when I was 1 or 2 years old was my father's broken camera. At age 11, I received a Kodak Brownie Starmatic for Christmas. And from that point forward, I never looked back. I also had a father who was a photographer in a very particular way. He was a radiologist. He took pictures inside the human body.
Wow.
And I remember going to his workplace and being fascinated with pictures. So there's never a point in my life where I wasn't a photographer, so to speak.
I always find that interesting, you know, to hear from people who started photography at such a young age and had been able to, you know, stick with it, I guess, their entire lives. But I want to go back to those early days and kind of stick within that moment for just another second. What do you think it was about the camera? Was it the result that you were getting, the images, or was it just simply holding this thing in your hand? What drew you to it?
The earliest memory that I actually have as a child, I was in my backyard in a little rubber swimming pool with a girl next door named Sally. And we were splashing in the water. And I remember looking around and I was entranced with the light of the world. I felt that I could almost taste it. It was palpable. And I had a feeling, a kind of a longing for light. And I've always been attracted to light, physical light, sunlight, as well as metaphoric light. And so I think that my attraction to photography was due to my attraction to light itself as an elemental force.
Knowing what you know now, it can be hard sometimes to capture light in the way that we see it with our eyes. Was there a steep learning curve? Like, is that, that's what you were trying to capture with your camera early on, right?
Yes, but the first lesson in photography for me was a difficult one. And it had to do with how we see the world. We all obviously see the world differently. I don't know how well you know American history, particularly during the Vietnam era. But I was a student at Kent State University in 1970.
Oh, wow.
I was studying photojournalism. And I remember in the class, the teacher was saying, photojournalism or journalism in general is an impartial recognition of the facts. And at Kent State, there was a student protest. Protesting President Nixon sending troops into Cambodia. Mm-hmm. And the protest heated up over several days. A photojournalist named John DeGroote, who was one of my teachers and mentors, was called in to photograph the event. He had a press pass, and I was asked to accompany him. And after the demonstration went on for a while, on May 3rd, 1970, the National Guard was called in, and the National Guard began beating students with gun butts. And I thought, what is going on here? This is Ohio. This is not Vietnam. And things were getting violent and rowdy, and I started having very strong feelings about the event. And John DeGroote, the photojournalist I was working with, said, try to stay in front of the facts. He said, reality is always more interesting and compelling than anything we might think and feel about it. May 4th, of course, what happened was National Guardsmen fired guns with real bullets into the crowd. They killed four and wounded seven or eight others. And I was tangled up inside. Here we have National Guardsmen who joined the National Guard so they wouldn't be drafted to go to Vietnam. They were the same age as the college students. Mm-hmm. They grew up in the same communities. And they're being asked to fire guns with real bullets, actually armor-piercing bullets into the crowd. Mm-hmm. I was completely tangled up inside, and I could not photograph the event impartially. And I recognize in that moment that photography's power is twofold. First, it's a way of exploring the world itself. And secondly, it's a means of self-expression. And I recognized in that moment I could not stay in front of an impartial recognition of the facts. My own feelings began to figure very prominently in the way I photographed it. And I recognized that I wasn't a journalist. Mm-hmm. You know, I had this ideal notion that being a journalist meant traveling around the world and making beautiful pictures of beautiful people in different cultures.
Sure, of course.
But in reality, photojournalism was a commitment to the social order. So I dropped out of college and I studied art because art is a way that you could express your own convictions. So the challenge of Kent State helped me understand there's different ways of seeing the world. And my first lesson was I didn't know how to see the world impartially. Now, of course, I was young. I think it would be more possible to do that today. But nevertheless, I'm not a documentary photographer. Mm-hmm. I'm a fine art photographer. And what I feel and think about things does figure prominently into my work. And I didn't really learn that lesson of how I saw the world until Kent State.
Do you think when you say that you think that it'd be easier today to be impartial to the facts, do you mean today with your age and experience or in today's age?
Today with my age and experience. I mean, I've been a teacher for 40 or 50 years, so you have to be impartial in the classroom. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what students you like or don't like. You have to treat everyone fairly and treat everyone the same. So being a teacher, I think, helps you learn to become more impartial. But I was 20 years old at Kent State.
This was a tragedy for sure. How do you deal with those emotions? Do you think for a number of the listeners who are hobbyists who have no intention of using photography for anything but to document, let's just say, their own lives, how important is it to still be able to be impartial to the facts? Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit.
Well, I don't think it necessarily is important for everyone. It certainly is for journalists. But I do think this. I think that photography's power is twofold. It's a powerful way of exploring the world itself. It's also a powerful way of self-expression.
Sure.
So I would encourage listeners to explore both modalities of photography. I mean, people go around the world. People travel. People live in communities that have issues. So why not use the camera as a tool to explore what's happening in your immediate world in addition to photographing your own family or your own travels? Mm-hmm. One thing I find particularly annoying is Instagram feeds where every single picture is a self-portrait. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, come on now. We live in a world of, 7 or 8 billion people? Yeah. Why are you so important? You know, why not use the camera to learn about the richness and the complexity of the world you live in, in addition to the very natural expression of yourself?
Well, you know, they just look really good that day. So they want everybody to know. So
they're having a good hair day, perhaps.
Yeah, it's just a really good hair day. That's it. I love that. It is it's difficult. And I think that these are like really big ideas, right? To everybody relates to seeing National Geographic and wanting to be that photographer who travels the world and tells right. these amazing stories. And I've said before, you know, that there's a power in being in living in a small town, you know, quote unquote, small town. I live in Indiana. I'm sure it was similar in Ohio. Living in a small town, it may not be a tropical location. It may not be the world's prettiest, but there's still stories that happen here.
Many stories.
Many stories. Yes.
And those stories are emblematic of the human condition. or the environmental condition. So yes, why not use your camera to explore those things in your own life, but also in your own community and surroundings?
Mm-hmm.
Camera, Dorothea Lange said, photographer Dorothea Lange said, a camera is an instrument that teaches people how to see without a camera.
Mm-hmm.
So using a camera is a way of engaging with the world, whether you're engaging with your family or a vacation or your own community. It is a way of engaging with something outside of yourself.
Hmm. They, our Idle Jorg Museum here in Indianapolis is having currently a Dorothea Lange exhibit that I am dying to go see. I don't know if it's a traveling exhibit. I would imagine so if it's here in Indiana, but I'd love to go check that out for sure. I want to know because you became into my universe through your book, The Mindful Photographer. And oftentimes over the past, I'd say since COVID, I have enjoyed social media less and less. I've spent less time even just on the internet in general, spending less time on photography blogs, spending less time on, you know, photography YouTube channels, all these things that are kind of traditional mediums today to learn the art of photography. And when I found your book, The Mindful Photographer, it felt like a breath of fresh air. Not only is it, I thought that it was a great introduction, I guess, coming from the traditional social media sense where it's full of relatively short essays, but they're all so strong and well thought out. And first, I just want to say thank you for putting out this book because it is truly enjoyable and has opened up my eyes to a lot of new ideas and concepts and just ways of thinking about photography. But I want to start off by just asking you, what does it mean to be a mindful photographer?
Well, I want to try to give some definition to the word mindfulness because all too often people think of mindfulness as looking inward, becoming aware of my body, my feelings, my mind, in an effort to relax and find inner peace. Okay, that's a good goal. But mindfulness really for me is 50-50. Half of your attention goes inward, you know, because all of your responses to the world take place in here. They don't take place in the out there of the external world. So half of our attention goes inward. We try to become aware of the state of our body, our feelings, our mind. And the other half of our attention goes outward, paying attention to the object, whatever it is we're looking at. And in that moment of paying attention to the object, I see that certain reactions are happening within. I always tell my photography students, if you want to make a good photograph, look outward until your heart starts beating faster.
Mm.
You know?
So we start with the outward. Experience the world around us.
We start with both, that there's a dynamic relationship between our internal being, our sensations, our feelings, our thoughts, and the outer world. The outer world provides impressions that come in. And it's like a musical chord. Sometimes it plays a harmonious chord within. Sometimes it plays a non-harmonious chord. And you know the phenomenon. If there's two guitars sitting side by side and you pluck a string on one, it'll vibrate on the other guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens with us. We're looking for those moments of resonance.
Mm.
We're looking for those moments where when something we see outside plucks the string of something we're feeling inside.
That is a phenomenal quote right there. I love how you put that. Now, when you say resonance, are we... when we first get into photography, the things that we photograph first are the things that we love, right? It's the things that are around us and the things that we love.
Right.
There's a lot of power to photographing the things that we love. But how much should we be chasing the things that, you know, resonate in the opposite direction?
That's a good question. The first assignment I give in my photography classes relates to that dynamic of seeing what is compared to seeing how I am. And the first assignment is make a self-portrait, not using yourself as the subject. And then the second part of that assignment is make a picture that expresses the essence, the character, or spirit of a person, place, or thing outside yourself. So I have people explore looking at the world as a metaphor for how it expresses themselves. And then I have people explore the world itself and try to make a picture that expresses somebody else's or something else's character. The second assignment I give is photograph something you love and then photograph something you hate. Mm-hmm. Many students react to the word hate. So if they choose to, they can change the word hate to outrage.
Mm-hmm.
Photograph something you love and photograph something that you feel outraged toward. Because not all photographs need to be the rule of thirds, pleasant, harmonious, flowing documents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can make photographs that challenge the viewer. We can make photographs that reflect some of the more difficult problems that we face as a global society. If we don't incorporate an art medium in expressing both the beauty of the world and the problems we all face, then what is the value of art to the broader society?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a big question. How do your students react to taking a photo that, say, of something that outrages them? What do they find afterwards? Hey, Raymond here, and I know that diving into the world of editing can feel like navigating a maze, especially if you're just starting out. So that's why I created our exclusive collection of 52 Lightroom presets, absolutely free. While presets can dramatically enhance your photos, they're not a one-click solution. They're a starting point for your creativity and an opportunity to learn and grow in your editing skills. These presets work seamlessly with all versions of Lightroom, whether you're on a computer or using Lightroom Mobile. And they're designed to simplify your editing process, adding that professional touch to your photos while giving you the flexibility to fine-tune them to your taste. So if you're ready to take your photos to the next level, head over to freephotographypresets.com right now and get editing today.
It's hard to say. Many of the students get very literal and very superficial. You know, oh, I hate broccoli. Or some such thing like that. So it's really one step on the path toward going deeper as a photographer. Some students take it seriously. In fact, two things that I find a lot of my college students do with this assignment is, number one, when I say photograph something you hate, a lot of students are deeply concerned with the environment and what we're doing to it, and they make pictures of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that's surprising to me is a lot of college students are concerned with what I would call body positivity, and they're very outraged by the way people, especially women, are portrayed in the media.
Mm.
So these are two topics that I see coming up consistently in my classes when I give that assignment.
Now, are these photos just, say, photos of women who are being, for lack of a better term, objectified in print, or how are these images coming across?
Well, they will photograph people that, for example, women that are frightfully thin and heavily made up, you know, or they will photograph advertisements like billboards and signage in malls and stores to make the point that there's a certain objectification of women that takes place through the photographic medium.
Sure, sure. If I were to ask you to take a photo of something that you hate, what would that photo look like?
Well, that's an easy question. I photograph the land. My concern has been throughout my working life about the environment. And, you know, I am deeply moved. That's not strong enough. I'm I'm heartbroken. I'm completely stymied by how people are treating the environment. So I've made a number of pictures that reflect my thoughts and feelings about the environment itself and what we're doing to it.
Now, one of the things that I love about photography is how we can use it as a tool to amplify a message, right? We can either make something, and as a wedding photographer, I can make the bride look better than she did on the wedding day, and I can also make her look terrible, you know?
Yeah.
So in this challenge to photograph something that we hate, and I'm sorry that I'm so focused on this. This is just so interesting because it, I guess that resonates with me. It's like, ooh, this is so different than what I'm used to, I suppose. Are we trying to empathize with that thing? Are we trying to show it? Are we trying to showcase this object and how we feel about it, which would be terrible?
Some of the strongest photographs for me are photographs that have what I would call paradox or opposing dynamics.
Yes.
You know, there are photographers like Richard Mizrak, like the Canadian photographer Edwin Baczynski, that makes sumptuously, incredibly beautiful photographs of damaged landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And that paradox between the beauty and the actual subject is very moving to me. You know, when I was a young photographer and I experienced Kent State, and I had a lot of close male friends that went to Vietnam, and some did not come back, and some came back all shot up. And I had very strong feelings about the violence I saw around me. So given the current Barbie craze, what I did as a young photographer is I collected baby dolls that I found in the trash. And I took them out into the woods, and I took some gasoline and lit them on fire. And I did my burning baby doll series that was meant to kind of mimic the napalm of the Vietnam War and as a way of expressing my very strong feelings. One of the projects I did recently in Honolulu was photograph what I call brown water. You know, we're now in a position where the ocean turns brown, mm-hmm. dark brown, after a rainstorm, and they're beautiful photographs, but damn, they send a very horrifying message.
Sure, sure.
So that paradox between beauty and environmental degradation is present in a lot of strong photographs today.
Hmm. So, thank you for sharing that. I like that. It's not just the thing itself, but it's the thing in relation to how it's affecting, say, something that you like or something that you love.
Yes, and of course, you know, beauty, we have a very, our culture has a very strange relationship to beauty. We always see it as something very positive. But the Greeks had a word called pathos. Beautiful word because it expresses beauty against the recognition of our mortality.
Mm.
So pathos is this combination of beauty tinged with sadness. And it's often the sadness that comes from our own mortal lives.
It's crazy to be a human, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a wild ride. It's a wild ride.
It totally is. Especially when you start to age.
I'm seeing it every day. Every day, you know, I look at my son who's 11, is almost 11, and my mom just sent me a photo that she had taken when he was just like 9 months old, and I look at that kid, and I still see my 10-year-old as that 9-month kid, and you know, you ask yourself where did that time go, and it's wild. I'm glad that we have cameras to document those things and to relive those memories. It is very powerful, but I'm sorry.
Well, one other point I want to bring up. You know, what you say, you're glad we have cameras to document these things that are important to us.
Mm-hmm.
That's another powerful aspect of photography. It's a legacy. We leave things in the world. You know, I have never walked on the moon.
No.
But I know what the moon looks like.
Yeah. Yes.
And how do I know what the moon looks like from photographs? So what we leave behind is a legacy of moments that become historical. Mm-hmm. I always tell my students, never, ever, ever delete the picture unless it's a butt dial and a picture of the floor. Ah. You know, you never know when a picture will become important. So, for example, I am not the same person I was 5 years ago. Very often we take pictures that are ahead of ourselves. So we take a picture now, we don't like it, we're going to throw it away. But then 5 years from now, we recognize, oh, this is one of my strongest pictures. I just needed to grow into it. And many, many times, I've wanted to throw pictures away and then found them to be historically significant. A historian came to my house about 25 years after the Kent State Massacre. He wanted to look at my contact sheets. And he said, oh, my God, you have a picture that changes our understanding of the event. One of the students that was killed was apparently just walking to class, but she wasn't. I have a picture of her in the front lines of the demonstration. Mm. Now, that doesn't matter. She should not have been shot.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, when President Clinton had the Monica Lewinsky scandal, 50 photographers took pictures of a certain event, and that was President Clinton hugging a White House intern. Mm-hmm. 49 people took that picture on a digital camera and deleted the picture. One photographer took that picture on film. And after the scandal said, oh, my God, look what I have.
Mm.
But even in your own families, I mean, I know pictures that I threw out when I was a kid that documented moments in my family that I wish to hell I had today. So we never know about the future. Yeah. The camera becomes a very important tool for maintaining memories, for maintaining a family legacy, for maintaining a historical legacy in our community.
I need to get better at taking less photos, I suppose, to justify keeping all of them. It's funny. I routinely delete all the photos that I decide not to keep, right? That I don't choose as keepers, but yet I also think about all of the weddings that I wish that I could go back and look at the entirety of the images that I shot, and yet still I don't make any changes. So maybe I need to take this as a warning that I should do so.
Well, you never know when you're going to grow into an image. Something you made today, maybe your unconscious made the picture, and you're not aware of its power until a little bit later.
Wow.
You know, if you make 10 pictures, slight variation on a theme, I'm not recommending keeping all of them, but I'm certainly recommending keeping several of them.
Yeah. Well, I might have to change my culling practices because that's a very important point, you know, especially about the shooting film, and because who else would have kept that photo if it didn't mean anything at the time? I want to ask you a question about one of the essays that you wrote in Mindful Photographer. You wrote an essay where you talk about your time critiquing and viewing lots of images and how oftentimes you find that photographers are taking pictures and those pictures are about the pictures and you take the opposite stance. Can you kind of walk me through what it was that you had discovered there?
Yeah, I love that phrase they came up with. Pictures are not about pictures.
I had to read that twice and make sure that I read that correctly, but sure enough, I did.
Pictures are about something. So when people are beginning in photography, and we all do this, I did this, I still do it to some degree, we're always concerned with making a good picture. And the goal of making a good picture supersedes any other goals. Whereas photography, above all, is a communication medium. You know, we are communicating something to others through our photographs. So pictures are about something. They're not just about the picture itself. They're not just about the rule of thirds or about, you know, what you can do in Lightroom or Photoshop. pictures represent something in the world. Pictures say something about the world. They say something about yourself. And we need to start attending to the communicative power of the medium, not just, is it a good picture? Actually, some of the most powerful pictures I've seen, by most definitions, are not good pictures.
Yes.
You know, they break the rules, if you will. I'm so tired of the rule of thirds. The rule of thirds is wonderful if you wish to create harmony in picture.
Mm-hmm.
But is harmony your only goal? What about visual tension?
So how do we break past that? How do we break past? Because when we get started in photography, we want to learn how to use the tool, right? We think that we're learning photography, but we're just learning how to use the tool. How do we break past that so that we can start to include meaning in our images?
I don't think we break past it. I think we evolve through it. We have to learn the tools. We have to learn what makes a good picture. We have to follow the rules at the beginning. There's no question. You know, I'm so happy that I learned photography in the darkroom. There's so many principles about light and exposure that I learned in the darkroom that are much harder lessons to learn digitally. But I do think that coincident with learning the tools, you also need to learn what does it mean to be authentic? Who am I? And how does that bleed into my photography? When I look at people's photographs, the first two things I look at are, number one, is the picture authentic? Does it grow directly from the heart and mind of the maker? Or is it merely an imitation of all the pictures they see in the media? We all have in our mind hundreds of thousands of pictures that we see on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. Invariably, we are going to imitate some of those. But we need to find our way through that to discover, who am I really? What is my own in a picture? And that grows concurrently with learning the medium. Once you begin to learn something about what is my own, what is your own way of seeing, then your own way of seeing becomes more important than the rules that govern a good photograph.
Mm. So it sounds like if we're trying to imitate the photos that we see every day, the thousands of photos that we may see every day, that is almost like, I don't know, junk food, for lack of a better term, right? We're just trying to redo these things that we've seen over and over again. But when we learn how to, or when we practice being more self-aware and photographing the things that resonate with us, that's more like a full meal, right? Like a healthy, healthy meal there. So
yes.
I guess my question is, when it comes to the junk food, when it comes to, say, a healthy meal, we can quantify those by, say, the nutritional facts. But how do we quantify, how do we measure what is a good photo? How do we measure what is a well-conceived, well-executed image?
Well, why don't we ask the question, how do we measure authenticity?
How do we measure authenticity? Yeah, that's a good question.
So one of the assignments I give my students is, you know, the assignment in art school where you work in the manner of. In other words, you take pictures that directly imitate different artists or different photographers. I often give my students the assignment to take pictures in the manner of painter Edward Hopper.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find when people consciously imitate is they come back and they look at their pictures like, oh, there's something here of me. So no matter what you do, there's always something there of you. I can tell in a photography class, by the second class, whose pictures are whose.
Mm-hmm.
But the students can't see that. everybody has something that makes their pictures unique. Maybe they have a certain feeling for color or tone. Maybe they have a certain dynamic of form and shape that they use repeatedly. Maybe they have an attraction to psychological complexity or an attraction to social injustice. These things show up in their pictures almost immediately. And then, you know, they look at Instagram or they look at popular photography feeds and they start imitating. I have a very advanced group of students, and something I saw in the past couple of years, they're starting to make pictures that are all high key, very pastel color. And I said, where the hell are you getting this? And they're getting it from Instagram. Mm-hmm. Because that's a contemporary cliche. So we have to be mindful of when our pictures are being influenced in a way that doesn't work. Now, obviously, we want to be influenced in ways that do work. But this high-key pastel color phase in Instagram is just a phase. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. So one of the things that's important is to take a lot of pictures. TMP, take more pictures. When I go out in the field, the first half an hour is just kind of making the pictures that are my attempts to emulate the masters. And then I find something more authentic. I find beginning photographers to be really, really arrogant because they think they can walk up to a scene, take two pictures, and walk away. Mm-hmm. Huh. Why is it that I've been a photographer for 50 years and I need to take 50 pictures before I start taking pictures that really work for me or that are really authentic? People don't understand that you need to warm up. If you were an athlete, you would never consider running the race without warming up first. Mm-hmm. A pianist would never go on stage without warming up first. Why do beginning photographers think they don't need to warm up by sketching out ideas with a camera that they're going to get a great picture within the first 5 minutes of engaging the subject? Mm-hmm. A professional photographer, a friend of mine, was asked to do a portrait for a cover of a magazine. He brought 50 rolls of film.
50?
50. Wow. He took 30 of those rolls for one cover picture and two interior pictures. Mm-hmm. Mm. A professional photographer knows that they don't know, that they have to work their way into an engagement with the subject. When I used to, my girlfriend hates this because she finds it exploitive. When I used to work with paid models, the first two rolls of film, there was no film in the camera. Because you need to develop a working relationship with the model, who's often a stranger, and you need to get into the groove. There's something called the flow, the creative flow. Mm-hmm. When we enter the flow, we are seeing more deeply and more authentically. But we need to warm up a little bit in order to enter the flow.
It's also a great way to stretch the production budget, for sure. Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I wondered, do you think when it comes to, you know, going out there and shooting, and let's say, because I know a lot of new photographers right now are thinking, you know, what if I got the photo within two photos? Do you think that it's a misunderstanding of what it is that they're trying to capture? Because you said that with you, you need to warm up. What are you warming up for? Is it, you know what it is that you're trying to say, right? So I guess how can beginners get to the point where they know what they're trying to say so that they...
I'm warming up so I can be more juicy. I'm warming up so I can engage the creative flow, so I can enter the flow where things are alive and juicy. When I was a Boy Scout, I got a photography merit badge. I think I was 16 and... So I'll never forget what that teacher told me. He said, after you've made the photograph you set out to make, now's the time to start exploring. Hmm. You never know. Okay, you've got the picture you want. But remember, that our conscious mind only represents 5% of our total brain. So is that the picture we really want, or is the picture we really want lurking somewhere in our unconscious? It takes a while to uncover our unconscious response to things in the world. So I would say you got the picture you want on the first go around. That's great. Now is the time to start exploring the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And my next photography teacher had a question. He would always ask, and what else? And what else? I got a great picture. And what else? Did you continue exploring? He would say.
That's a hard thing. That can be such a hard thing. And yet so easy at the same time, you know.
Why is it hard? It's fun.
No, it is fun. But I guess then it always brings in the question of doubt, right? Because if you think that you got the photo, it's almost like, why keep shooting? So I went to film school before I got into photography. And there was a huge pet peeve of mine when you would do a take, say, with an actor, and the director would say, that was perfect. Let's do one more for safety. And I'd always be like, it clearly wasn't perfect if you want to do another one. But then say that safety take wasn't a good one. Well, now they need to keep going and keep going and keep going. And there's this feeling of doubt, at least that I feel inside. So I guess how do we shift that from knowing what it is that we want to capture to exploring it deeper? How do we become open to that?
Well, let me tell you a story of Alfred Stieglitz, the photographer.
Yes.
Somebody asked Stieglitz, what is your measure for a good photograph? And he said, let me tell you a story. This was in the days of glass plates. He said, I go out and make a photograph. It sums up everything I've been trying to say. It's the perfect quintessential photograph. I take it into the dark room. I process it. It's a glass plate. I bring it out. I look at it. I recognize its completeness. I've said everything I need to say. I drop the plate. It breaks. I die. So there's never, ever, if you're not an artist or a photographer, if you're not searching, if there's not a continual search for excellence, a continual search for going farther, I can tell you that the times I thought I nailed it, can I use bad language here? It's often boring.
Yeah.
Because very often when I keep working, there's something even more exciting lurking around the next corner. So that example of the actor and the film, and they nailed it. Does that mean that you've gotten everything you can out of the actor? Or can you squeeze a little more out of their expression? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's just a personal journey to figure out when enough is enough.
But especially today. We are not paying for film or developing today.
Right, right, right.
That's a huge freeing factor.
Yeah. I want to ask you another question based on another one of the essays that you had written. And you had written, I guess I don't have the name of the essay right here, but you had posed the question, you said the question for photographers is, can we be instinctive and unrehearsed in our seeing and image making, yet apply conceptual rigor and necessary knowledge or craft to our creation? When you had talked about all of your students suddenly shifting their visual style to be more high key, a little bit more pastel, they're seeing influences from other photographers. But creativity can't happen in a vacuum. So how do we find that blend, and how do we get back to that beginner's eye?
Well, I would argue that we are tripart beings. We have bodies, we have minds, we have feelings. And the body, the senses, they know proportion and balance. They know the meaning of a line, the meaning of shape. The emotions know the value of color. But it's the mind that is charged with grappling with content. So an instinctive, intuitive way of seeing means that we use our body, our senses, and our feelings in the moment when we're taking a picture. If I often do this, well, I did this in the classroom. People tell me it's too dangerous to do now. I used to stand in the classroom and throw my keys to somebody across the room.
Jeez.
And they would catch them.
Yeah.
And I said, now, were you thinking about that? No. So what is the proper role of the instinct and the senses, the proper role of the feelings and the mind in making pictures? The mind is engaged before or after we take the picture. Mm-hmm. The mind is engaged in terms of getting us to where we want to go. Like, what location do we want to take a picture? What person do we want to take a picture of? But in the moment, it's our senses, it's our feelings that are engaged. The mind is too slow to follow an unfolding moment. And then the mind is involved later in making decisions about post-processing and making decisions about, you know, those kinds of things. So
sure.
We have to be present in the moment. And that often means going beyond the rational brain and depending upon other sources of wisdom within us, like the wisdom of the body and the intelligence of the feelings.
David, so much to think about here. I love how my brain wants to go in 19 different directions and try to figure out the right one. But I know that we're coming to the end of our time. I appreciate you coming on here and sharing it all. I love that, thinking about how we see the world in those three different ways, how we experience the world. And I'm going to try to frame that next time I go out and try to see if I can be less, analytical and a little bit more emotional while I'm out and just see what differences happen in my images, because that's a very interesting experiment. So I appreciate that.
I would say to beginning photographers, I would say to all photographers, be who you are. You have a very particular way of seeing the world. It's there. You don't need to discover it. You need to uncover it.
Mm.
So the more you work and the more you strive to be authentic, there's no need to emulate great photographers. The real need is to simply accept that you are a unique individual. And if you allow it, if you let it, it will come through your pictures.
That was beautiful. David, before I let you go, I want you to share with the listeners where we can find out more about you, what it is that you're working on, and your images and your books as well.
Most of the information about me is available on my website. It's www.creativeguide.com. Creativeguide.com, one word. And I have numerous portfolios of photographs of projects I've worked on. My books are there, including my two most recent books. The book that came out in 2018 is titled Zen Camera, Creative Awakening with a Daily Practice in Photography. My most recent written book is titled The Mindful Photographer, Awake in the World with a Camera. That came out in a year ago. Both of these books are available online through booksellers like Amazon. And if you've read one of these books, I actually recommend reading both. Zen Camera is more of a photography teaching, and Mindful Photographer is more reflections on photography. I just finished a book of photographs, a project I've been working on for the past few years, It's titled Oceano, An Elegy for the Earth. It's photographs of the Oceana dunes on the Central California coast. And that book was literally just released early July. And that book is available on my website or through most booksellers except Amazon. And, you know, if somebody reads my books and wants to communicate with me, my email is listed on my website. I'm always interested in dialogue. And I do teach classes online that are available for everyone.
Perfect. David, again, thank you so much for coming on. And I look forward to keeping up with you in the future.
Well, thank you, Raymond. You had great questions. I really enjoyed this dialogue. I hope the listeners enjoyed it also.
I had more than three big takeaways from this interview, but I think the three biggest takeaways that I had, number one was the importance of uncovering and not discovering. You know, when it comes to figuring out what it is that we like in photography, how we can use this tool, creating images that are us, we can't do that by discovering something. We have to do that by uncovering something. I know that it's hard to understand if you feel like, oh, the style thing is so hard. Like, how can I be uniquely myself? How do I form this style? It is. It's in you. It's already in you. You're already shooting in your style. You just are so close to it that you can't see it yet. But when you start to realize, oh, holy cow, like when I shoot, you know, this thing, I don't know, families, but I also shoot this thing, events, I see the visual similarities. That is your style. The things that you start to do together, right? Over your body of work. That is your style. And that comes from within you. What you discover is like tips and tricks. What you uncover is who you are in your images. It's yourself in your images and just how important that is. And when you have a photo that is just focused on, you know, settings and, you know, composition and, you know, what lens you use, things like that, you can have a good photo. But it's not until you uncover what makes you a unique photographer and you can put that in your image that now you have a great photo. Takeaway number two was TMP, man. Take more pictures. TMP, take more pictures. If you're not happy with your work, TMP, go take more photos. If you are struggling with posing, well, guess what? TMP, go take more pictures. If you need more work to edit so that you can learn, you know, I don't know, some sort of new technique, well, TMP, take more pictures. The more photos you take today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow. You hear me say that? I'm not just making this stuff up. Other photographers see this as well. TMP. Now that's the answer. TMP. I love it. And lastly, my biggest takeaway was to have deeper perception. Have deeper perception. You know, it's all about learning to see. We all experience the world that we are in. There are other people in our city. There are other people in our state. There's other people, you know, in our homes, but we all experience things differently. We all perceive the world differently. And when you can lean into who you are as a photographer and capture the world around you through your eyes, through with this camera, with this lens, you know, and create an image with emotion and how you perceive it, you're showing others how you see the world. And I mean, that's everything. That's everything. That's what you want in photography. So learn to see and learn how to communicate that in your photos. That was it. Did you know that you can actually download a photography action plan for this interview over in the Beginner Photography Podcast community? Yeah, it is like Cliff Notes for becoming a better photographer. So not only in each photography action plan are you going to get a summary with the biggest photo lessons of the interview, but you're also going to get an action plan for the you know, the steps that today's guest took on getting to where they're at in their photography so that you can start to do the same, you know, start moving your skills forward. So these photography action plans are only available in the free Beginner Photography Podcast community. So come on in, join us today by heading over to beginnerphotopod.com/group. Again, that's beginner photopod.com/group. I hope to see you there. Well, that is it for this week. Until next week, remember, TMP. The more you shoot today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.